From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Today's show is a celebration of an important part of Georgia's population. National Hispanic Heritage Month comes to an end this weekend, and so we'll revisit some of our favorite conversations about the Hispanic experience in Georgia. And we'll start with one of the most divisive political issues at play in this election, immigration. More people are prosecuted for illegally crossing the border than any other federal crime, but these inmates are not held in prisons run by the U.S. government. They're placed in a little-known system of private prisons that were set up in order to save money. There are 11 immigration prisons across the country, and two of them are here in Georgia. The February issue of The Nation magazine examined what happens inside these prisons. Seth Freed Wessler wrote the piece. He's a reporter with The Nation Institute's investigative fund, and I spoke with Seth earlier this year. Here's an excerpt of that conversation.
I've been hearing for years reports about neglect in private prisons. And some of those reports were coming from people talking about this kind of federal prison that had been privatized that I had never heard of before. And what I found is that the federal government has set up a separate system of prisons and has contracted those prisons out solely for the use of holding non-citizens who've been convicted of crime. So if a non-citizen, somebody who doesn't have U.S. citizenship, is convicted of a federal crime and considered a low-security prisoner, they'll go to a different prison than a citizen would for the same crime. And then what I learned is that 40% of the people held in these federal prisons, 11 of them, 23,000 people are now held in these separate private federal prisons for immigrants, that 40% of those people were prosecuted criminally. They landed in prison for the crime of crossing over the border. That is a criminal offense attached to border crossing. It's now the most prosecuted federal crime. More people are prosecuted for border crossing than for drugs in the United States. And those prosecutions, which have skyrocketed in recent decades, have really helped to fill the federal prison system.
How long does, on average, does someone spend once they arrive at one of these private prisons? How long are they there?
It can really vary, but I reported on men, and they're all men. Women are mainstreamed into the regular Federal Bureau of Prisons system, but immigrants who are men can spend years in these prisons, several years often, and all of them will later be transferred to immigration authorities and deported. But what I found is, while they're held, these prisoners are being held in facilities that operate under a separate and less stringent set of rules compared to the rest of the Bureau of Prisons system. And generally speaking, the logic of these prisons, the Bureau of Prisons, has said that non-citizens are an ideal group to be held in private facilities because that offer somewhat fewer services that prisoners might need to return to their communities to reenter. But because these people will later be deported, the federal government has said that they're not required, it's not required to provide that same level of services. And the federal government has applied a less stringent set of rules in the management of these facilities. So the private companies have more leeway to decide how they're going to run their operations. And in the context of medical care, which is what I looked at, that's led to real troubling situations where prisoners are not receiving the kind of care that they need, often not seeing doctors at all and being treated by low-level workers, often right. Licensed practical nurses who simply don't have the skills to provide the care they're being asked to.
Let's actually take a listen to that very issue. You spoke with the family of Nestor Garay, who was an inmate at one of these prisons. He died after he was left unattended for hours. He'd suffered a stroke. This is his mother speaking about her son's death. She's speaking on the public radio podcast Reveal.
Fíjense qué crueldad.
I mean, look at the cruelty here. It wasn't until after they took him off life support that they took the shackles off. It was as if they were saying, if you're still alive, then you're under my control.
So let me add to that the voice of Russell Amaru. He was the physician assistant on call during the early moments after Garay's stroke. He says there was a vocational nurse on call. That nurse did not communicate Garay's systems and actually was not qualified to perform a diagnosis. But he says this whole thing is not his fault.
You had an LPN right out of school, new in corrections, trying to make an assessment. he did not have the skills. I don't blame them as a person. I blame the management system that puts him in that position.
Why? Is this just a money-saving thing, or is it just simply the fact that these are private prisons and therefore don't have oversight?
It's both. These prisons have not been forced by the federal government to follow the same rules in the provision of medical care that other Bureau of Prisons facilities do. And one of the areas where that is the case is the kinds of medical workers that do various kinds of work. And the private facilities, because those rules about who does what are not applied, are not part of the contracts that these companies sign with the federal government, the private companies are moving to hire less trained and less expensive workers. In the case of Nestor Garay, his cellmates heard him at about 1:30 in the morning moaning in pain and called for help. And a guard came and then called for backup from the medical unit. But the only person on call that night was this licensed vocational nurse, also called a licensed practical nurse in some states. And the doctors who read these files, as well as the physician's assistant that we just heard, said that that LPN or LVN was simply not equipped to deal with that kind of emergency situation. You know, in Federal Bureau of Prisons-run facilities, night shifts are staffed by registered nurses, more highly trained registered nurses, or EMTs who are trained specifically to deal with emergencies. But these prisons are very often using licensed vocational nurses. A medical worker in one of the prisons that I interviewed told me that there's really no difference in the prisons between the way that registered nurses and licensed vocational nurses operate, even though their training is vastly different.
Really, really different. You can get an LPN stands for licensed practical nurse, and you can get a certificate for that in a couple years. What kind of recourse does someone have? For example, Nestor Garay's family, do they have any recourse to either sue someone or hold anybody accountable for his death?
Well, you know, I wanted to figure out what was happening in these prisons. So I issued an open records request to the federal government asking for the records of everybody who's died in one of these 11 contract facilities used for non-citizens. And those files are filled with stories of the last weeks, days of the lives of these men who died. And in 25 cases, independent doctors that I asked to review the file said that the care was both inadequate, but that those inadequacies likely contributed to the premature death of these prisoners, that they likely would have survived had they been provided baseline kinds of medical care. And those files sometimes, in fact, acknowledge there are internal investigations or reviews that the prisons themselves conducted that acknowledge that the prison care had failed. But in one case, one of those internal investigations that a company called Management and Training Corporation had done to review a suicide of a man who was known to be seriously mentally ill but not provided any mental health care in the time leading up to his death, they investigated what had happened, quote, in anticipation of litigation. But that litigation never happened, and that's because this family, who are in Mexico, knew nearly nothing about what had happened to their brother and son. So the young man, about 30, who'd been arrested and charged criminally for illegal reentry, and he was held for months in a federal prison. This family didn't know for months and months that he had died, and when I finally called them, more than a year after his death, they still didn't know why he'd been locked up.
Seth Fried-Wessler is a reporter with the Nation Institute's Investigative Fund, and I spoke with him in February. The Stewart Detention Facility in Lumpkin, Georgia, processes thousands of immigrants and refugees every year. More than 97% of these people are eventually deported back to their country of origin. That process can be heartbreaking for both the detainees and their families. But many of them have found comfort with the help of Amilcar Valencia. He's the director of El Refugio Ministries.
We have a small house. The house is just a mile from the detention center. So the families can come to our house either before or after the visit. We're open during the weekend. We offer meals, we offer some comfort, you know, some friendship to the families who, you know, are going to this rough moment of their life to have, you know, a loved one in detention.
Amilcar and his group of volunteers spend almost every weekend of the year at El Refugio. They stay busy even when the center has no guests.
We also visit the people who are in detention. So that's another service that we do. We bring groups to the facility to visit with detaining immigrants who might have or not have families in the United States. And for many of them, our visitors, our volunteers, are the only, you know, people that they have received visits from.
Amilcar says the people who stay at El Refugio are often distracted and grieving and in need of comfort.
These are people who are going through difficult moments of having a father, husband, son, or a friend detained. This woman, her father was deported. Then her husband was detained. And she came again to visit him, and he was deported too. And now, recently, her brother was also detained and was deported too. So she's been through so many rough times, you know, her father, her husband, and her brother being detained and deported.
El Refugio has helped many people enjoy the time they have with loved ones before they're sent out of the country. We reached out to one of those guests.
My name is Hannah Yusun Cho, and I am currently residing in Atlanta, Georgia, and I came from South Korea 21 years ago.
Hannah traveled to Lumpkin, Georgia last year to visit her boyfriend at the Stewart Detention Facility. They stopped by El Refugio and were welcomed with open arms.
They cleared out the dining room and they set up a bed so that we could sleep there. And they were very welcoming and extremely kind to us. We got to talk to the hosts a lot, and we just asked them like little stuff. Like we normally our conversations would be like it would touch on the subject of why we were there and you know who we were visiting. But we got to connect with them, and it was really great. We got to know them as people.
For Hannah, having a welcoming place to stay made a world of difference.
It was a godsend because people go there on Saturday and they also visit on Sunday because they stay the night. And that way we're able to have 2 hours of visitation because technically visitation starts over on Sunday, which is the first day of the week to them. We've met people who came down from New York, from South Carolina, North Carolina, from someone flew in from California even.
Hannah's boyfriend eventually lost his legal battle. He was deported last August. And although the pain is still sharp, Hannah still remembers the kindness she received at El Refugio.
They fed us. They gave us all the utilities that we needed. And that it meant a lot to all of us, really, like, because we were all in the same spot. And it was, the people there were wonderful. They were just really wonderful.
For more on El Refugio, visit gpbnews.org. Just ahead, do you know the difference between the terms Hispanic and Latino? We'll break it down for you. First, though, we'll go back generations to talk about the long history of Mexican migrants in Georgia. This is On Second Thought. When we talk about the Jim Crow South, we often hear about segregation between blacks and whites. But racial tension had a broad effect on everybody living here. Drinking fountains were often labeled either white or black, but many Latinos wondered which one they should use and if segregated lunch counters meant they weren't welcome. In her book, University of Oregon history professor Julie Wise tracks the mass migration of Latinos to the South and what they faced when they got here. I spoke with her earlier this year. Javier Gonzalez joined that conversation. He's a descendant of some of those early migrants. Javier's father was a farm worker, and Javier grew up doing tough field work. These days, he oversees multicultural programs at Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College. I started the conversation by asking Javier when his family came to Georgia.
We started settling in Georgia in the late 1970s.
And you came from where, Texas?
From Texas, yes, South Texas.
So how did you end up here?
Well, my parents were recruited. Back then, farmers hired recruiters to go out, and they would go to South Texas and other places to recruit farm labor. And my parents were one of those that saw the advertisements and said, let's try this, and packed up our family and ended up in Georgia.
And the thing is, having looked at your bio, Javier, it looks like you moved around a lot. So what was it about Georgia that made them stay?
It was full-year employment. As a migrant, as migrant workers, we would follow the crops. Or they would follow the crops, and we would follow. But Georgia, in Georgia, he found stable year-round employment with one farmer who had worked for him and the family throughout the year.
So, Julie, how typical is that story, the story of Javier's family?
What I found in my research is that it's actually quite typical, that we have a long history going back really to the 1920s of Mexicans and Mexican-Americans being based in South Texas, or in some cases Mexico, and moving seasonally through the country to harvest crops, oftentimes spending summer in the Midwest. But what happened as Georgia's agricultural production became more seasonal, less cotton-based, was that people who were spending the winter months in places like Texas or Florida could find employment in Georgia, and they wouldn't have to go all the way to, let's say, the Midwest. So because of the climate of Georgia being able to accommodate crops in various different seasons, it became an attractive destination in the 1970s and 1980s for families like Javier's, based both in Texas and also in Florida, who would come to Georgia maybe for part of the year, then most of the year, and then maybe realize they could stay all year.
So, Javier, tell me about, what does your family talk about when they talk about what seemed strange in Georgia? Were there things here that stuck out in terms of kind of a culture clash?
Yeah, definitely. One of the most vivid one is being exposed to the African-American population, because coming from South Texas and living there the majority of the year, most of our of influence and people were people like ourselves. They spoke our language. They looked like us. And even when we traveled as groups, we mainly stayed within our little communities. We traveled to Florida, and Florida was the same. But it was coming to Georgia where we got to get an extended view and exposure to the African American population. That was one of the most vivid changes.
You know, Javier, I grew up in Southern California, and that's another place where my hometown was Mission Viejo, and my high school mascot was a Diablo. Everywhere you go, things are in both Spanish and English.
Right.
That could not have been true here. Was there a language barrier that hadn't been there in Texas?
Oh, definitely, definitely. For my family and myself, it was academically challenging because we were doing well in Texas and under the bilingual programs that they have in South Texas. So we were functioning in our native Spanish language, and English was slowly being introduced as the student progressed through their education. The most difficult time was coming to Georgia, and South Georgia at that did not have the resources, either bilingual or English for speakers of other languages, to support what we needed.
So, Julie, you kind of begin your story of Mexicans in the South in 1910 or 1920. Why? What was happening then?
Well, the Mexican Revolution that unfolded over the course of the 19-teens is generally considered to be the most important precipitating event for the migrant streams that have really continued until this day, really until our recent recession, when we've seen net Mexican immigration effectively at zero. But prior to that, for a century, the Mexican Revolution was really the event that kicked off the modern Mexican migration to the United States. And while we are very aware that those immigrants were going to places like Texas, California, Chicago, it turns out that they were actually going all over the country. country. They were going to Alaska, they were going to Pennsylvania, and they were going to Louisiana, Mississippi, and Arkansas in the 19-teens, really through the first part of the 20th century.
You have some great examples in your book of how that played out, especially as the civil rights movement began to brew up in the South, and that sort of strange place that Latinos and Mexicans held, not quite sure where they belonged. Can you give me an example?
Yes, absolutely. So if we look, for example, at Arkansas, during the 1950s, Mexican workers who were imported on temporary contracts, these workers were known as braceros, which comes from the Spanish word for arm. And during the 1950s, Mexican workers did about 25% of the cotton labor in Arkansas. They were a completely ubiquitous presence in the Arkansas Delta. What we saw there was a very interesting dynamic wherein Mexicans and African Americans, in oral history interviews and through other documentary evidence, it becomes clear that they were spending their free time together, that Mexicans felt most comfortable in African American bars and honky-tonks, as they would call them. But at the same time, the Mexican immigrants are appealing to the Mexican consulate for the right to be admitted to white businesses and restaurants from which they were excluded. And they ultimately win that fight because the Mexican government says to the white employers, if you don't put pressure on these businesses and these public spaces to admit Mexicans, we're not going to give this area any bracero contracts next year. And because the farmers wanted that labor so badly, they worked very, very hard to secure Mexicans' admission to white public spaces. However, what's not really clear is that any of the Mexicans who were fighting those very fights actually wanted to spend their time in those places. They wanted to be recognized as equal. They wanted to be recognized as first-class citizens. They took up this issue, but all the evidence says that their free time, they actually preferred to spend time with African Americans.
So, Javier, let me take that straight to you and how that played out in your own personal life and with your family. You said it was, Georgia was the first time you'd really been along a lot of African Americans. What did that look like in terms of socializing with your family?
Well, it was natural because that was the population that was doing the farm work. So we spent extended amounts of time out in the fields and the packing sheds and in social locations with that population. So socializing with them really promoted collaborations and friendships, particularly with that population more so than the white population.
Do you feel, and did your family feel, like they were in part of the civil rights movement, like as though that included Latinos in the South especially?
I don't believe so. My parents, they had basic education, primary level education, third and fifth grade educations, and their purpose for coming to Georgia was to do the work. So they were not involved, and we didn't know because lacking the language skills and the history skills, we were not aware of that struggle. It wasn't until later that we were established that we started, or I myself started, to notice differences and wondering why these things are that. And then I realized the integration had just occurred, relatively speaking, and they were, the school system in particular, were struggling to figure out where we as the Mexican in-between population fit within those dynamics.
Where did you go to a segregated school?
No, I did not. But I did go to a school where there was tracking placement of students in tiers depending on their ability or potential. So when we enrolled in schools, we were placed in the lowest tiers possible. Some of my siblings were even placed in special education classes because I believe their lack of English proficiency. And we had to work our way through those barriers to get into the higher achieving groups.
We're going to return to that in just a moment, Javier, because you're getting close to finishing your PhD now, right?
It's an EdD program, yes.
Yeah, that's a pretty amazing leap. But Julie, help me understand. You know, I found it interesting. I want to read you a sentence that's from your promotional material, which I don't often do, but I found this interesting. They said that in your book you talk about how Latinos in the South shaped the Southern conservative imagination in the wake of the civil rights movement. What does that mean?
Well, what I'm referring to there is specifically things that were happening in South Georgia during the time that Javier's family was coming. And I'd be very interested in Javier's perspective about this as well. But what I argue in the book and what I found in my research is that this is a period when white Southerners are really beginning to be looked at by the rest of the country as the bad guys of the civil rights movement, the people who stood in the way of what ultimately came to be accepted as a somewhat general consensus that legal segregation was wrong. And of course, many, if not most of these people came themselves to accept the idea that the harshness of the Jim Crow system was something that had to be placed into the past. At the same time, they were reaching out, other scholars have established, they were reaching out to African-American leaders, pastors, asking for forgiveness, that kind of thing. But that was extremely complicated. That was a very complicated way of making amends because not all of these African-American leaders wanted to simply say, yeah, we're going to forget about everything that happened, you know, since slavery times. Well, all of a sudden at this moment, enter this new population of Mexicans. Many of these conservative white Southerners had been on missions in Latin America. They had learned some Spanish. And so what we saw during this period of, I'll say, the 1970s, really through the 90s, was a somewhat quiet and uneasy peace in southern Georgia and similar agricultural areas, where on the one hand, you didn't have the migrant workers, as Javier said, organizing and protesting the way that migrant workers were doing really in many other parts of the country. Well, in the 70s.
Cesar Chavez and similar things in
Florida and in Ohio, but not in Georgia. Similarly, you didn't see any real anti-immigrant movement coming neither from white nor black people in South Georgia's agricultural areas. Instead, there was this uneasy peace, and I argue that this was largely, or in some ways, an opportunity for conservative white Southerners, particularly those affiliated with churches, to sort of redeem themselves, to have this population that did not look like them, that represented difference, that they could go out to the camps, bring people food, charter buses to bring them to church. Conservative white Southerners who would invite 30 Mexican migrants over for Christmas, for dinner.
So that's the broad experience. Javier, give us the individual experience. Did you find among at least your family and the people that you knew, there was neither a big, strong political push for civil rights nor a feeling of anti-immigrant backlash?
Exactly. Just thinking on Julie's words, that the farmer who my parents settled with kind of took us in and made us part of his family. We shared Thanksgiving. He brought Christmas gifts, him and his wife and his extended family. So we were taken care of in that way. There was never a distinction where you would say, you know, we're being treated wrong or something's not right here. And just thinking back on that, it was more of a mutual respect relationship than a worker-employer relationship.
So before we go, Javier, I want to return to the story of your education, because as I understand it, you actually keep a letter framed on your desk from one of your early teachers.
Yes. And this is from Virginia Roberts, and it's dated November 19th, 1980.
What grade were you in at this point?
Fifth grade, I believe.
Okay.
And it was when I moved to our permanent school system from another school system within Georgia. And it says, to whom it may concern, please do not judge Javier's ability by the grades he received from me. He is a very capable, polite person. His work was very good until he began being absent 1 to 3 days a week. His absence seemed to be due to the temporary nature of his father's job. Javier's concern for his schoolwork seemed lessened when the cucumber crop came in. My plea to you is give him a few days to adjust to the new school. You will find him easy to learn and a pleasure to teach.
Why do you keep this? I mean, it's like an absolute reflection of your family and the realization of the American dream in one way, but why do you keep that on your desk?
It motivates me. It makes me realize that people do care. I didn't see my potential at that age, obviously, but someone else took interest in me and made sure that whoever was going to be receiving me at the next school felt the same way.
That was Javier Gonzalez. He's the director of multicultural programs at Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College in Tifton, Georgia. I also spoke with University of Oregon professor Julie Wise. She's the author of the book Corazón de Dixie, Mexicanos in the U.S. South since 1910. That translates to Heart of Dixie. We always love to hear your stories as well, and we'd love to hear your family's origin story. How did you get here to this state, and how long has your family been in Georgia? You can share your story with us on Twitter. It's at OST Talk. Or post to Facebook. You can also just call us and leave a message. It's 404-500-9457. Coming up, what exactly is the difference between Latino and Hispanic? We'll break it down for you. This is On Second Thought. Here's a scenario for you. Imagine a priest from South America becomes the Pope, because that's what did happen, and it appeared in headlines around the world. First Hispanic Pope, some read. Others said Pope Francis becomes the first Latino Pope. And one even said first Spanish Pope. Then an online magazine enters the discussion with this headline: Pope Francis is not Latino and barely Latin American. What? Latino and Hispanic are often used interchangeably, but actually they're not the same thing. So who is Latino and who's Hispanic? Let's break it down. Ooh, break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you again. Break it down now. Break it down. According to the U.S. Census, Hispanics are the largest minority group in the country, and their numbers are growing. Nearly one out of five people in America has Hispanic roots. Or is it Latino roots? And what about Cuba? They call me Cuba Pete. I'm the king of the rumba beat. When I play the maracas, I go tick, 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 tick. The discussion over what to call people with roots in Spain, Central America, South America, or the Caribbean is ongoing, and it's not always civil. A few years back, CNN aired this report.
CNN's Thelma Gutierrez shows us you can't define race by just checking a little box.
What are Latinos? What do they look like? You may be surprised.
We go from black to white. So we have mestizo, we have indigenous, we have Arab.
And some of us are Asian. I'm Chinese and Mexican. But contrary to what most people think, Latino is not a race, and it's not a particular ethnic group.
The discussion in the comments for that video was entertaining.
Hispanic is an ethnicity, not a race.
No, Hispanic has nothing to do with ethnicity. Oh my God, it has to do with language. Please go back to school.
Latino or Hispanic is not a race. Latinos are those who speak languages derived from Latin language.
Spaniards are Hispanic. South Americans like Brazilians, Argentinians, and Portuguese are Latinos. However, people use both since it means the same thing.
You know Portugal is not in South America, right?
I'm Portuguese, and Portuguese people are not Hispanic.
Wikipedia has an entire page dedicated to what it calls the Hispanic-Latino naming dispute, so let me try and clear this up as best I can. First of all, this confusion is a uniquely American problem. We are really the only nation that calls people either Latino or Hispanic. Outside the U.S., people are described as Cuban or Guatemalan or Mexican. But it was a Texas woman who recommended the U.S. government use the term Hispanic to describe this very large, diverse group of people, Grace Flores Hughes. She says the term's meant to include all people of Spanish descent. She doesn't like the word Latino because she thinks that includes everyone whose language is based on Latin, and that would include Italians and other Europeans.
Some people like to argue that you're not Latino because you don't speak Latin. But that's just silly because Asian people don't speak Asian. They speak Japanese or Korean or Chinese or Thai.
Let's settle the simplest one first, Spanish. Spanish is a Romance language spoken by about 400 million people around the world.
Claro que sí, mi amor. Voy a vivir contigo, Juan.
Spanish is also a nationality, and it refers only to people who are from Spain. A Mexican is not Spanish, even though he or she might speak Spanish. Now let's move on to the more complicated terms, Latino and Hispanic. There are some who say the two terms are basically the same thing.
We use them interchangeably, but actually Hispanic is an English term and used to really refer to people from Spain, and then it kind of expanded to refer to people in Spanish colonies.
That's Soledad O'Brien, who's half Cuban and half Australian, but born in St. James, New York, so she's 100% American. But many people don't agree that Latino and Hispanic are interchangeable, so let me explain the distinction. Hispanic refers to someone whose ancestry traces back to Spain or another Spanish-speaking country. So, Soledad O'Brien would be Hispanic, because Cubans speak Spanish. And Cuba was claimed for Spain by good old Christopher Columbus back in 1492.
Christopher Columbus, at your service, sir. I'm told you're an Italian.
Oh, indeed I am, sir. From Genoa.
Latino, for most people, doesn't refer to the language Latin at all. Instead, it means you trace your ancestry to Latin America. Okay, quick geography lesson. Latin America starts at the southern border of the U.S., goes south all the way to the bottom of Chile, and stretches east to include the Caribbean. Cuba is part of the Caribbean, which means it's part of Latin America, which means Soledad O'Brien is both Hispanic and Latino and Caribbean American and Cuban and just plain American. Got it? Stay with me here. Let's do a quick quiz. If someone is from Brazil, what do we call them? Latino, because she's from Latin America, but speaks Portuguese, not Spanish, so she's not Hispanic. How about a guy from the Dominican Republic? That guy is both Hispanic and Latino, because the Dominican Republic is a former Spanish colony where people speak Spanish in Latin America.
We got another notice from the fire department saying we have to clear out the bush. You said you were going to get Jose to do it.
He's your garden, and why you don't tell him?
Lucy, you know I don't speak Mexican.
I'm not a Mexican.
Great, what was that all about?
Lucy's from El Salvador.
So?
It's an entirely different country.
Hispanic refers to a history with Spain or the Spanish language. Latino refers to a specific place on the map. I know a lot of this can be confusing, so take a tip from me. Unless you're the U.S. Census and you have to separate people into groups, don't worry about the labels at all. Just call the person Soledad or Celeste or
Angela, Pamela, Sandra, and Rita,
or whatever their actual name is. That's a quick lesson in the difference between Hispanic and Latino, but I am neither. So let's bring in an expert to make sure we got it all right. You've heard Hector Fernandez before on the show if you're a frequent listener. He's a professor in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at Georgia State University. He's also a regular member of our Friday break room. Last year, we discussed the many differences between being Latino and Hispanic. So here's an excerpt from that conversation. Here's the thing. Since we said we were going to be talking about this, we've gotten tweets from listeners all saying, okay, here's what the difference is, and they're all different. And these are smart people. How come we can't decide this?
Because it's typical. It's a mess. Different people have different views. The government issued, the government embraced the terms within a certain context, and then the culture ran away with the term. Society took it elsewhere.
Which term are you talking about, Latino or Hispanic?
Well, first of all, Latin American. Latin American comes from the French in the 19th century. Then the U.S. government, so I'm speaking about the people who live over here, not people elsewhere. The Pope, for that matter, is Latin American. From the Nixon administration, the term Hispanic came from the Nixon administration. And close to 30 years later, within the context of the Clinton administration, the term Latino emerged officially. That does not mean that the terms were not used before. They were used before. But those are the points of official embracement or inception. the different originally was somewhere along the lines of Hispanic was favored by people on the East Coast, and Latino was favored by people from the West Coast originally. Now it's all mixed, so it doesn't really matter. But on a general basis, it has to do with this. Hispanic means, whether you like it or not, you're prioritizing, you're giving more importance to your European descent. Hispanic, whether people realize it or not, in terms of the word itself, comes from Hispania. And Hispania was a Roman colony. And sadly, for the Brazilians and the Portuguese, that Roman colony included Portugal. The part of Portugal was called Lusitania, Hispania, Lusitania, but it was part of Hispania, if you want to be really strict about it, which I don't endorse. But originally, that's the way it works. Latino, on the other hand, is not about European descent. People who identify with Latino is because they want to prioritize coming from Latin America, having a Latin American context, being proud of sometimes mestizo roots or mulatto roots or something else that doesn't have to be with all Europe. So generally speaking, those are two big differences.
What do you make then of this argument that Latino means that your language derives from Latin?
See, that's I'll give you a great example. Antonio Banderas, right?
Right.
He comes from southern Spain. He moved to the States. He married Melanie Griffith, you know, the works, whatever. He became a star over here.
The became culture, Zorro, yeah.
Yeah, the culture calls him Latino. And he is Latino. But he's from Spain. He doesn't have anything to do with Latin America. To that extent, you would have to justify then, just for him and for a few other Spaniards, you know, the reading that, sure, he comes from Spain. A context is basically emerging from, you know, Latin, the language. So the definition doesn't work equally for everybody.
Wait, we would call him Latino instead of Hispanic? Well, you'd call him both Latino and Hispanic,
yes.
Even though he's not, he's from Spain. He's not from Latin America.
Yeah, I wouldn't call him. The culture calls him Latino.
Oh, I see.
The culture alludes to him as Latino. He's Hispanic and Latino. Personally, I call him Spanish. He comes from Spain.
Yeah, he's Spanish.
He's Spanish. But the culture calls him at Latino, and all the films he has made, you know, for the kids and stuff, I mean, they market him as a Latino star.
So let me read you a couple of these tweets and get your response. We have one from at That Was Deep, who says, this mostly indexes generational/political outlook. Younger, more English-speaking are Latinos, older Hispanic. Hispanic, as functional term, took off through government, especially the census, based off language, ethnicity, and then identity model. What do you make of all that?
On a general basis, I wouldn't disagree. I would say one thing, though. Latino is basically embraced by people. There is a big distinction, which I wouldn't draw so much between Hispanic and Latino, but between Latin American and Latino. A lot of people migrate to the States, and they keep on calling themselves Latin American for years. And it's only when you identify yourself with the U.S. context and you say, I live over here, this is my home, this is my place, then you become Latino.
Interesting.
You have people who live, 40, 50 years in the States, they speak only Spanish. They never learn English. And you ask them, and either they have a nationality, some other nationality, or they'll say, I'm Latin American. So that's another distinction. On a general basis, what they wrote about Hispanic and Latino, sure. But I wouldn't give much importance to what the government said. You know,
yeah.
I mean, the government said something, and that was lost long time ago.
So why, I mean, we talked about this, and in almost no other countries do they split people this way. Is this argument over Hispanic versus Latino? And one of my friends was like, well, why can't I just be Guatemalan? And why do you think that is? Why has our country had these struggles over these labels?
Because first of all, we want to integrate people. We're talking about the nation. We're not talking about, you know, a conglomerate of nationalities. You're going to become American. If you're going to become American, sure, you can have a double nationality if you want to. But for practical purposes, you have to be something over here. And very few other nations in the world have the mixture of nationality we have. And the processes, the cultural processes by which we integrate people into our population are perhaps unique. I mean, the only country in the Americas that remotely resembles the cultural and racial diversity that we have is Brazil. And the mechanisms for integration in Brazil are sadly lacking in comparison to us.
So you are originally, your family's from Colombia, correct?
Yes.
So you are Latino.
I'm Latino.
And also Hispanic?
Yes, I'm Hispanic, but I don't
You don't like to be called that.
I don't like to be called Hispanic.
Because you don't like to reflect back on European ancestry.
I have no problem with it. The language I speak is European descent, whether it's English or whether it's Spanish. But I'm not European. And that, to me, is very clear.
Do people offend all the time by using the wrong term? Do you get offended when people call you Hispanic?
No, I don't get offended. I don't think anybody has a chip on their shoulder to that extent. I mean, some people take it radically, but on a general basis, you know, there's such a confusion in the culture that I think Carly would take it, anybody would take it badly.
Okay, so can we go back to the Pope?
The Pope.
Okay, so the Pope is from Brazil.
The Pope is from Argentina.
Argentina, excuse me. The Pope is from Argentina. He speaks Spanish.
Yes.
He obviously, since he's the Pope and he's okay with the Vatican, it seems like he wouldn't have a trouble reflecting back on Europe, right? So we could call him Hispanic?
He's Hispanic, yes, absolutely.
And Latino, because he's from Latin America.
He's not Latino because he does not live in the United States of America. Latino is a label for people who live in the United States of America. He's Latin American.
Oh, this is an interesting wrinkle here. So the Pope is Latin American mm-hmm. and Hispanic,
yes,
but not Latino because he's clearly not American.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Okay. And Hispanic to the extent that he comes from Argentina, which is a country that has a strong history of immigration with, in some cases, well, with more European roots than the rest of Latin America. That's why you would label him Hispanic in some sense. But more than anything, I would say the Pope would define himself as Argentine and Latin American. And that's it. Hispanic and Latino are labels that we use for our population over here.
In America.
In the States.
That's an American problem.
It's not a problem. it's just an American practice, a cultural practice.
Hector Fernandez, he's a professor of world languages and cultures at Georgia State University. We've talked about a lot of things in our explainer series, Break It Down. What is gluten? How does net neutrality work? What is schizophrenia, really? What else do you think many people get wrong? Is there a word or a phrase that you think lots of people use but don't really understand? Call us and let us know at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us. Our handle is at OST Talk or post it on Facebook. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.